It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, an international memorial day for the victims of the Holocaust, the genocide that resulted in the annihilation of 6 million Jews by the Nazi regime and its collaborators during World War II. When one stops and thinks about the Holocaust, the magnitude of the human slaughter, the depth of the tragedy, it can be overwhelming, especially within the confines of one day. So we're going to spend this part of the program focusing on one angle. One particularly compelling story is told by our next guest, acclaimed novelist Ayelet Waldman, whose new book is due in April. It's called Love and Treasure, a historical novel based on the true story of the Hungarian gold train in the Second World War. Ayelet Waldman will give a presentation tonight at the Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures Literary Evening Series. It's sponsored in part by the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh. Ayelet Waldman, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Paul. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You already knew a lot about the Holocaust, but apparently you never knew about the gold train. How did you find out about it?
It's embarrassing to admit how I found out about it, because usually we like to think of our ideas coming to us in some sort of either mystical or some mystical manner or through great knowledge. I found out about it on Google, quite honestly. I was simply Googling around looking for a topic to write about, and I came across this story. And, you know, I'm a Jewish girl who grew up in Hebrew, going to Hebrew school and going to even Hebrew high school. And I thought I knew a lot about the Holocaust. I'd read a lot about the Holocaust. I'd studied it in college. And this incident was completely unknown to me.
And you spent some time living in Israel. Lived on a kibbutz for about a year when you were in high school. How did that experience and how has it over the years informed your writings?
My experiences in Israel? That's an interesting question. So I was born in Israel. My father moved to Israel in 1948, actually 47, but in time to fight in the War of Independence. And then we moved back to Canada and then the States when I was a girl. And then I went back in high school and I went back after high school. I had never really written about those experiences in Israel. And I didn't even think I was going to be writing about them now. But the kibbutz that I lived on in Israel was a kibbutz founded by German Jews, Jews who had escaped from Germany before, just at the very beginning of Hitler's rise to power. And most of them had lost families during the Holocaust, but none of them were themselves survivors. But the importance of that history to the founding of that kibbutz and to the founding of the country in general was in the air. I mean, Israel is a place where on Yom HaShoah, which is Holocaust Remembrance Day there, which is a different day than here in the States, the entire country grinds to a halt. There's a siren that goes off and literally traffic stops. So if you can imagine, you're on one of Pittsburgh's 200-some-odd bridges, and the siren goes off, and cars stop, and people get out of their cars for as long as the siren is going. So, and I think that's really symbolic of how important the historical basis for the founding of Israel is to the country and to the people there, and how it permeates their sense of identity. And as someone who went back and forth as a child and as an adult, I think that was kind of contagious.
You were quoted as saying that the Holocaust is the topic that every Jewish writer writes about, or writes around, or near, or against, were your exact words. Along with that feeling of inevitability, is there also a feeling of dread because the Holocaust is such a painful topic, particularly for someone who is Jewish?
I actually think it's a little different than that. I think there's a feeling of dread because not so much because of the pain, but because of the dangers inherent in writing about the Holocaust. Now, I'm not, you know,
the dangers.
Well, how can I put this without insulting another artist? But there is a kind of movie or book that is sort of Holocaust kitsch. And I think I'll just go ahead and do it. So my daughter read the book Thief and loved it. She's 12 years old. It was a incredibly important for her. She wept. She was moved. She felt like she understood more about the world reading the Book Thief. So I'm not going to talk about the book, but we recently as a family watched the film The Book Thief, and when the credits rolled for that movie, I always found myself in the state of fury, because it engages in all these kind of sort of kitschy tropes of the Holocaust. The good Nazi is one of them. The wonderful Nazi who's doing his best, or the good German to save people. Now, there were good Germans, which I don't mean to say that all Germans were terrible, awful people. But there's the way that we kind of glorify those good Germans in these movies. And the same way that I think it's African Americans have always seen their struggles portrayed in film and in literature in this country through the eyes of sort of the one good white person. You have sort of a tale of the struggles of an African-American family told by the young white girl who sees it all. So that's the same way that a film like The Book Thief, it's, a tale of the Holocaust told through the eyes of this beautiful little blonde German girl. And there's something about that that feels really kitschy and dangerous, especially if you're a writer, if you're a Jewish writer, but you're not a writer with direct personal experience of the Holocaust. So I think I tried to avoid the topic, though. I think it crept in despite my attempts to avoid it for many, many years, because I didn't want to write that kind of Holocaust kitsch. I didn't want to write a book that took advantage, that used this experience for easy emotional gain.
So what was it about the Hungarian gold train then that told you, this is the story, this is even though this is a novel, but it's based on this actual train, this actual event that was part of World War II and the Holocaust. When did you know, okay, this is the direction I need to go in?
Well, let me tell you the story a little bit of the train, and then you'll see why. So for me, it was the fact that it was first of all, that it was about property and not people. So that sounds almost counterintuitive. Like, wouldn't you want to tell the story of the people? But I felt like this, because the story was about all this property, it was a way to talk about the people without sort of appealing to kind of the more sentimental baser instincts. So basically what the Hungarian gold train is, and there are a couple of great reference books about this that if anybody's interested, they can reach out to me over email and I'll refer them to them. Hungary was an ally of Germany, and Hungary was actually not terrible to its Jews during the course of the war. They weren't put into ghettos. They weren't exterminated until the very, very end of the war. And among the first things that happened was a series of edicts were issued demanding that Jews turn over their property. I mean, everything from bicycles to telephones to jewels to cash, turn their property into the post offices and the banks. All this property was then sorted, collected, and eventually when the Russians began to invade Hungary from the east, the property was loaded onto this long train, something like 34 and 54 cargo cars, and then it just left Hungary one step ahead of the Russians and sort of traveled, perambulated around Middle Europe, this huge train full of massive amounts of wealth. And then ultimately ended up, when the war was over, in the hands of the Americans. And it was this kind of hot potato. I mean, what do you do with a train full of the accumulated wealth of a massacred people? Who does it belong to? What's going to happen to it? Who gets the proceeds if it's auctioned? Or the surviving remnant, is it theirs? And it became this kind of discussion about the nature of property and the meaning of value and survival. And I found it so completely fascinating. And I also couldn't believe – I mean, there were estimates between that the train was worth, between in contemporary dollars, $500 million and $7 billion. Can you imagine that? And I'd never heard of this story, and I thought I'd read everything.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with novelist Ilette Waldman about her new novel, Love and Treasure. One of the leading characters in the book is a Jewish-American soldier, Jack Weissman. He's one of those who discovered the train. What can you tell us about this character?
So this is a character that I actually based in a way on my own father. So my father was in the Canadian – during World War II, my father never fought in Europe, but he trained – he was in the Canadian Ski Patrol, and by the time he was ready to be sent over, the war was over. But Jack is a Jewish army officer at a time when there were many Jewish soldiers, but they experienced a certain amount of anti-Semitism, more depending on where you were stationed. And there was also this dual loyalty. And when you were a Jewish American army, you know, a soldier or officer, you were fighting on behalf of your country, absolutely, but you were also fighting for all these people. I mean, the Jews of America knew fairly early on what was going on in the camps. I mean, as soon as the information started to seep out, it was in the Yiddish newspapers, it was in the Jewish newspapers in the United States. So they knew, although they didn't really understand the extent of what was going on in the camps, they certainly knew that the Jews were being murdered and put into these camps. And so the Jewish soldiers had this real sense of that they were fighting for their country, but they were also fighting for their people. And I wanted to write about that, about a man who felt that dual sense of loyalty and also what it must have been like to be a guy in your, you know, their kids. They were in their late teens, early 20s to see the sites of, for example, Dachau. The Rainbow Division of the U.S. Army 42nd Infantry liberated Dachau, and a bunch of kids walked into that scene. I mean, can you imagine what that must have been like for them?
So as this story goes along, there's all of the difficult part of the story with these items in the train that – and what they represent, and
right,
the lives of so many people and what was lost. Was it also difficult for you to realize that the good guys, the American soldiers, could end up not necessarily doing the right thing?
Right. I mean, you know, I think as a fiction writer, what's interesting is to explore the notion of there not really being any good guys, that everybody is ambivalent and everybody is ambiguous. And so, you know, the Americans in Europe, that greatest generation that did marvelous, marvelous things. And but they also souvenired their way through Europe. I mean, they took a lot. There was this concept called souveniring, which is the American soldiers would take things from houses.
But not just the Americans.
Yeah, everybody was doing it. Every army was doing it. And then, you know, armies have a long history of doing that. We call it souveniring. Sometimes we call it looting. And the gold train became this, it became almost like a commissary. So here you had, which is not, you know, I don't mean to condemn the officers who are doing this necessarily, but so imagine that this is now post-war Salzburg, and you have all of these American soldiers and army officers who are now in charge of the rebuilding of Austria, of Germany. They're living in these houses that they have that have been, you know, requisitioned for them, but that have been stripped bare. The Austrians who turned over their homes, they didn't leave their stuff for the Americans. They stripped all their personal stuff and their furniture and their dishes and everything and left them basically the four walls of a house. And here you have this American army officer who needs, say, a tea kettle and carpets and sheets and then there's this and nothing is available in post-war Europe. Post-war Europe is going through this terrible economic crisis. But then there's this warehouse full of stuff. The owners of the stuff are dead. Nobody can figure out what to do with this stuff. So they start borrowing it. They start requisitioning it. So General Harry Collins will say he needs a service of dishes for 32 people because he's frequently entertaining high-ranking various government officials. So he requisitions it. Now, does he requisition thinking, oh, I'm going to steal the stuff of these Jews? No, he requisitions thinking, I need dishes. But then he packs up and goes home, and all that stuff ends up going home with him and all the other generals. So suddenly, what seems really understandable becomes less so.
And then another aspect of this book is a very strong woman who is one of the central characters. And without giving too much away, talk about how she comes into the picture and the impact she has, particularly on a guy like Jack Wiseman.
So the novel is told from the point of view of three different men, but it's really about these three different women. And the woman with whom Jack falls in love is a woman named Ilona, who's a Hungarian Holocaust survivor. a survivor of the camps. And it's through Alona is as close as this book will allow that I would allow the book to get to talking directly about the concentration camps, because I didn't feel like I could take the reader into the camp. I didn't feel like I had the strength as a novelist to do that in a way that I didn't feel like that wouldn't be exploitative. But the ramifications of the camp are writ on Alona's body and spirit and soul. And it's through her that we see what the price, the human price that was paid by the war and by the extermination, virtual extermination of the Jews.
And with regard to the research you did for this book, and the story, the love story that plays out, was this something that happened? Were there American soldiers who was it conceivable that soldiers could have come across women like this? And
sure. Yeah. I mean, there was it was actually more common that American soldiers would fall in love with young German women and young Austrian women.
About the refugees?
But the refugees, yes. There were DPs who met soldiers. I think frankly, if you're a 19-year-old man, the woman who survived the war, who's had food and who was sort of a plump milkmaid, is a lot more attractive to you than the woman who's been ravaged by the camp. But that's not the kind of man that Jack is. So there were relationships like that. I didn't want to, I wanted to make that feel as real as possible and to sort of talk about. I did more research into what relationships were like for people who had survived. I mean, what does it mean to fall in love after going through that experience? And what does it mean to create a family after having lost your first family? And there's a fair amount of, I found these great European sort of psychoanalytic studies of survivors and surviving families that were really fascinating and heartbreaking. And sort of the way that these stories would play out in the next generation and the next generation and even the next generation.
Was writing this book, was it cathartic for you in any way?
I'm not sure how cathartic it was. My husband used to say
Imagine who your husband is, by the way.
Michael Chabon, yes. Which is one of the reasons that I love Pittsburgh
Pulitzer
so much.
Pulitzer Prize winner and Pitt graduate.
And Pitt graduate and Pittsburgh lover. Michael used to say that it drove him crazy, the period that I was working on this book. It was about 3 years. He would say that I could turn any cocktail party conversation into a conversation about Treblinka. It was really like there was a while we just stopped going out because nobody, you don't need that person at your party. You want to like talk about the Oscars, say, not about the ramp at Auschwitz. So I'm not sure that – I don't know if I believe in catharsis so much, but there is a certain way that I needed to write about this, and I found a way that I could write about it and still feel true to myself and to the history, I hope.
Ayelette Waldman will give a presentation tonight at the Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures Literary Evening Series. It's sponsored in part by the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh. Her new novel, Love and Treasure, is due to be available in April. Ayelette Waldman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Paul. It's always such a delight to be in Pittsburgh. Even in the freezing cold.
Yes. Well, you're from Montreal. It's no problem for you. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Katie McGinty is our guest. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.